Very welcome to Joshua Shepherd and to Emmanuel Bristol's event, To Leave or Not to Leave. Hopefully going to solve all our questions over next week's Euro referendum. Before we do anything else though, I want to just take a bit of time out and to pray for the family of Jo Cox. Some of you will have picked the news up this evening. Jo Cox, Labour MP for Batman Spen, tragically murdered this afternoon. So it'd be great just to pause at the beginning of this meeting and pray for her. So let's do that. Father, we thank you so much for the life of Jo Cox, and thank you for her devotion to her country, her desire to serve in elected office, her clear commitment for her constituents. I want to pray particularly for that constituency today, who've lost their representative. We want to pray most of all for her husband, Brendan, family, friends, and particularly their two really young children. Father, we pray for those young children and their dad, and pray for them as they grieve. We pray that they will get all the support and love and help they need. And we do pray for justice to be done. And we do pray for this not to get in the way of the democratic process in this country in any way, shape, or form. And we pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. Let's keep on praying for Jo Cox's family in the days that lie ahead. This time next week is going to be Euro referendum day, and we will all be, I hope, going into the ballot box, or not the ballot box, that would be quite difficult. We'll be going into the little sort of cubby hole, and we will be presented with one of these. I haven't stolen this from Bristol City Council. They've already sent it to me because I'm registered for a postal ballot. The question will be asked of us, should the United Kingdom remain a member of the European Union or leave the European Union? And there's one box in which you can put a cross saying remain a member of the European Union, and another one you can cross a box, leave the European Union. I don't know what you're planning on doing. At the moment, I've got to get this in the next couple of days, at the moment I find myself sort of hovering with a pen over those two boxes, wanting somehow to put an X in both, but realising that will cancel out my vote. I don't want to do. And if you're in a similar position tonight, we hope tonight will help you work out which of those two boxes you're going to put your cross in. Who's going to be helping you? Well, myself, because I'm a bit of a political junkie. That's my only qualification for speaking today. If you haven't met before, I'm also the pastor of the Emmanuel City Centre, but today, political junkie hat on. But also in slightly more professional hands when we come to the other two speakers. Julian Rivers is Professor of Jurisprudence at the University of Bristol. Katie Corry got a law degree from Bristol and practicing as a solicitor today. And they're the sort of heavyweight expertise I'm here just to remind of a little bit of library. How are we going to do this? Well, we've got a programme. This is what we're going to be getting up to. We're going to be thinking about some of the background, some of the deep background to the referendum. What is the EU? What it does, what does it do, and how much does it cost? We're going to think of some of the principles, a Christian case for remaining in the EU, a Christian case for leaving the EU. And then we're going to do this a little bit of application, thinking through how does that apply to two of the biggest issues we've heard discussed sort of at length over recent weeks. First of all, sovereignty, that issue, and secondly, the issue of immigration. And then we're going to have what we hope is a discussion time. Nobody's allowed to come to blows. We'll have a discussion time, a chance for you to ask your questions, if you'd like to, right at the end. But we thought it would be fun to start, just with a little bit of a straw poll, as to where we're at the moment. Do not feel forced into declaring your hand if you think, you know, correctly that this is a private matter. You can keep it private if you want to. If you want to keep it private, do. But in a moment, I'm going to ask people in the room to raise a hand if you're going to vote at the moment to remain. Other people to raise a hand if you're going to vote to leave. And then we'll do the sort of undecideds. I'm going to see how representative this room is of the country as a whole. Okay? Don't do it if you don't want to, but if you are up for saying that at the moment you are thinking or you are leaning in the direction of voting for Remain, would you put your hand up? Your thinking is of heading towards Romania. Okay, so I haven't worked out the technology of how we count the votes there, so put your hands down. What about thinking towards voting leave at the moment? Okay, and don't know. Right. Okay, well, I'll put your hands down. So I can't actually work that. Right
cursor.
Right cursor.
Oh, good. There we are. Okay, this is what the poll's been saying recently, and in some ways, I suspect this room bears it out. We were, a little bit 50-50 split between Remain and sort of Leave, if you can have a 50-50 split with the number of people saying don't know as well. But what you'll see from this table is these run from the 3rd of June at the bottom, sorry about the sort of typeface not being too big, to just a few days ago, and you'll have picked up in the news that basically what seems to be happening is there seems to be a movement towards Leave at the moment. And certainly the polls that have been taken since the 30th of June would seem to confirm that if there's a direction of movement at the moment, it's towards Leave. Although you'll notice that the figures are very, very close, whatever, and that there are still polls indicating that it could go either way. And there's certainly a large number of don't knows, up to 15% in the YouGov poll. To the top of that. So, if you're a politician, everything to play for over the next week, and it could go either way. We could wake up on the 24th of June on our way out of the European Union, or we could wake up staying for the rest of our lives. Only time will tell. I'm going to hand over now to the experts, and we're going to find out what is the EU, and Katie's going to come to us.
Hi, I'd like to clarify that we're not experts. Neither are the European Union lawyers. I have 1 year of study at university and a lot of reading prior to this event, so yeah, we're not experts. And can I also just indicate that this doesn't reflect how we are accepting the vote? I guess it's here as a visual aid, so if you drop off during the evening, you wake up and think, oh, I know why I'm here. So I have the next 10 minutes to explain to you what I only scratched the surface of during a whole year of study. What I do hope is that the next 10 minutes will give you a little more understanding of where the EU has come from and how its aims and priorities have expanded and developed over the last 70 years or so. What is the EU? Well, the foundations of the European Union were very clearly born out of a very bruised post-war climate, with the central aim being to rebuild Europe and unite Europe. The first foundations were meant as stepping stones along the way to greater unity and the sense of being one's neighbour in Europe. And out of those foundations, we've seen the EU grow into what it is today. At the outset, the vision for the European Union was not set in stone, and it can be captured in Schuman's words in his 1950 declaration, which you'll see here, which is, Europe will not be made all at once, or according to a single general plan, but it will be built through concrete achievements which first create de facto solidarity. So what were these foundations? Well, they both happened in the 1950s, the 1951 Treaty of Paris. The Treaty of Paris created the European Coal and Steel Community, and this European Coal and Steel Community made countries dependent on each other for their production of coal and steel. And these resources, which were essential to warfare, were made jointly between the countries. And the countries wouldn't actually be able to go to war with one another. It would be impossible. And then later we see the 1957 progression, which is the Treaty of Rome, or I should say the Treaties of Rome. There are two treaties. One established the European Economic Community, which is what we'll be discussing tonight, which is where the EU progress comes from, essentially. And along with the EEC came the Common Market. And the other Treaty of Rome established the European Atomic Agency. There were six original members to these treaties, France, Germany, Italy, and the Benelux countries, which were all geographically located for the reasons that we mentioned before about sharing the coal and steel. Essentially, what were the aims of the 1950s treaties? Because by asking that question, we asked, what were the aims of what is now the European Union at the very outset? Well, there were four very clear key aims. One was economic development, the other one was European stability. We also see an aim for the rise in the standard of living across Europe. And fourth, the closer relationships between member countries was very important. Now, crucially to these 1950s treaties, the countries gave up some of their national powers to make decisions to the European Economic Community. And in that, an umbrella organisation was made. It's not quite as simple as that, but that's essentially the premise, is that this umbrella organisation was made so that the umbrella organisation could make decisions on behalf of the countries. The 1950s treaties saw positive success. Member states worked very well together and trade grew very rapidly, at the rate of 5% during the 1960s, which was double that of the UK and the USA at the time. So then we move on to 30 years of history, 1960 to 1992. That should really say 1991. And in one slide there, you get a very brief overview of the 30 years that we're talking about. I'm not going to talk about everything on that slide, but perhaps if the slides are available at the end and you want to know more, then it's something to look into further. What I do really want to pick out, though, is the sort of climate of the time, and the climate between the member states of the European Economic Community, those six countries, was very federalist. It was very pro-joint decision-making and an ever-closer union for Europe. On the other hand, you have a number of countries which see the common market as a very good thing, but they really want to keep decision-making at government level, and the UK was one of those. That distinction led to the creation of the European Free Trade Association in 1960, and this was essentially to rival the EU slightly. So it created a common market, it kept decision-making at a national level, and the member countries to that were Austria, Denmark, Norway, Portugal, Sweden, Switzerland, and the UK. And it didn't see the success of the EU, but it does still exist. Over these 30 years, we see countries then start to gradually join the EU, particularly in the late 20th century. The joining of more nationalist countries in some way challenged the more federalist aims of the EU founding member states. The nationalists have not always seen success in their aims within the European Union. They've often been overridden. The UK's decision in voting has often been overridden. We, as a country, other countries have had to sometimes negotiate an opt-out where we think the European Union goes too far. There was very clearly, though, as I said, a joint ambition of all EU member states for the common market and the economic progress of the EU in those years. So we move on then to the Treaty of Maastricht in 1991. Now, this was a very pivotal point in the history of the European Union, not least because it actually established what we know today as the European Union. It also created the status that every person in the EU had the right of an EU citizen. It established the Euro and the European Central Bank, both of which the UK opted out of. And it also established the European Social Policy, again, the UK opted out. It also saw the restructuring of the European Union through the creation of pillars, and there were three pillars. The first pillar really just collectively gathered up all the functions that the EU or the EEC had had until that point, and that covered what would now be called the European Community rather than the Economic Community, and the European Coal and Steel Community, which was still going then. Now, this pillar was crucially the pillar where governments had given a lot of say to the EU and where the EU had the most control over decision making. We then saw the second pillar, which was the common foreign and security policy, and the third pillar, which was cooperation between the member states in the areas of justice and home affairs. Pillars two and three can be distinguished from pillar one because governments largely kept control over decisions in pillars two and three. So I mentioned that Maastricht was pivotal, but why was it pivotal? Well, we discussed previously the aims of the European Union in the 1950s as one primarily unity and economic aims. But here at Maastricht was the first time that the EU had a political dimension to it through the creation of the European Economic and Monetary Union. at Maastricht, it's very clear that the European Union very much went beyond its original just economic and social objectives as political ambitions began to arise. So again, briefly, the developments after Maastricht. Again, I'm not going to deal with everything on the slide, but I'm going to deal very briefly with the treaties of Amsterdam and the Treaty of Nice. So Amsterdam 97, this was a revision of the Maastricht Treaty. It abolished a number of national vetoes that member states had enjoyed until that point and replaced them with a voting system. It appointed a high representative for foreign policy. It was their job to steer foreign policy for the EU and to represent the EU internationally, for example, at the UN. It established the co-decision procedure, which is now still in force today. And that procedure basically says that the European Parliament and the European Council can't adopt legislation without say-so of one or the other. So it's essentially a two-tier system for adopting legislation, which had no dependency previously. Nice reformed the structure of the EU, essentially just to cope with the plan of Eastern enlargement. In 2004 saw 10 countries joining the EU, and essentially the voting system and the weighting of votes that member states had and things like that had to be changed just in order to cope with this new number and make their representation fair within the EU. So finally then, developments to date. You'll see from this slide that a number of the EU developments bring us to where we are today. Again, we're not going to touch on them all. As a broad overview, what I would like to talk about briefly is the development of the Constitution of Europe. You'll see that in 2005, a proposed EU constitution failed. This constitution essentially wanted to strip away everything that had happened so far and create one single document which basically said, this is the European Union and this is how we function. But for numerous reasons, it wasn't ratified in member states. We were going to have a referendum here in the UK, but France and the Netherlands had already voted no, so it made it pointless because every member state had to ratify that constitution. What we see later, though, at the Treaty of Lisbon in 2007, there was a number of those reforms in the constitution actually drawn into the Treaty of Lisbon. Lisbon is actually called the Reform Treaty. Essentially, it was made to simplify the European Union. I don't know how simple you find it. I don't, so it's often drafted by lawyers. It did include much of the substance of the constitution. It abolished the three-tier structure. It clarified areas in which the UK had the power. In which the EU had the power to make decisions, known as areas of competence, and where governments retained control of decisions. It also sought to make the EU more democratic, and it reformed and strengthened internal and external policies. So that very broadly and very briefly brings you up to date. So I guess we need to summarise, what is the EU? Well, it's very different depending on who you ask, when you ask the question, and there is definitely really different views. But I hope that we've seen that it's an ever-changing institution. It's essentially at its core a collective body of European countries working together for the advancement of economic, social and political purposes, both in Europe and on the world stage. It's a body which seeks to create unity in Europe and to respond and develop to new situations as they arise. It really was a whistle-stop tour. If you need further information, then do contact me or ask me afterwards, and I can try and fill in the gaps for you and point you in the right direction. But now, we'll hand over to Julian for what does the EU do? Thank you.
Right, so this is very, 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 very complicated, and it took me a long time to draft the sentence on the screen, and having drafted it, I don't think it tells us very much. What does the EU do? Well, it formulates policy and makes law within the areas of competence and according to the processes set out in its founding treaties, as agreed and revised by its member states over time. That does not tell you very much, does it? What it tells you is something about the fact that the EU has a policy coordination function. It gets the member states to agree collectively on what we want to do vis-a-vis some problem or the rest of the world, but it also makes law from the top down, which it imposes on the member states by the processes that the member states have agreed to. I thought what I'd do then is just talk very briefly about the lawmaking process. You've got a bit of a sense of how that works. And then we'll go through some of those areas of competence that the EU has. Where does the EU make law? Which bits of our law are European law and which bits are domestic? So, very briefly, and you'll have heard of these institutions, but it's just worth having a quick idea of what they each do. In the middle of the EU sits the European Commission. This is it's most like a civil service body. It has commissioners appointed from every member state, but the European Commission is the body that really is the engine or the motor of European integration. It comes up with all the proposals of what we should do next. So it says it would be a great idea if we harmonised the conditions under which you can sue a manufacturer who creates a defective product which explodes in your face and injures you, for example. So they make this proposal, and then the proposal has to be agreed by two bodies. The first body is the Council of Ministers. The Council of Ministers represents the member states' governments. So you have your Minister of Trade or of Commerce or whatever from every member state sitting in the Council of Ministers going either, yes, we like that proposal, or no, we don't think that's a very good proposal. They vote by majority voting. Typically, you need to get about two-thirds of the population of the EU on board. So if you think there are small countries and big countries, so you need more small countries to vote for a proposal and a smaller number of big countries. But you have to get a majority, a qualified majority, a special majority, to support the proposal coming from the Commission. Not only do the governments have to agree, the Parliament has to agree as well. The Parliament is directly elected, you may have voted in European elections, and they too have to agree with the proposal. If there's a dispute about what the law means when it's been created, at the end of the day, the body that resolves that dispute is the Court of Justice, sits at the top of the court system, it works its way up through the national courts and eventually gets up to the Court of Justice. And the fifth body it's worth being aware of is the European Council. The European Council represents the heads of state, the prime ministers of each country, and it really agrees the high policy and the treaty amendments and things like that. Those are the five main institutions. I think it's just worth pointing out and reiterating the fact that things only become European law when they are agreed by a special majority of the member states' governments within the European Union, and when the democratically appointed representatives also agree in the Parliament. It's a lot more complicated than that in practice, but that will do for now. What we really are interested in, I think, is trying to get a hold on the areas in which the EU works. And I've divided them up into about five groups. That the oldest and the biggest core of the European Union is this thing, the common, internal, or single market. They probably mean the same thing. There's a bit of a dispute about that. Let's say they mean the same thing. A common market, an internal market, a single market, built on the basis of four key freedoms. There should be free movement of goods, free movement of services, free movement of capital, free movement of workers. You can get up, take all your money out of your bank in Henry's or wherever it is, walk over to France, set up a company, start employing people, and they might come from Italy and Greece and so on, and start doing business anywhere in the EU. That's the principle of freedom, the four freedoms. The problem is that freedom meets obstacles. Not just obvious obstacles like tax and customs duties, that's the customs union. You might, for example, meet an obstacle that the company law of the country you've gone to says that you have to be resident in that country in order to set up the business in that country, and suddenly you've got an obstacle to your freedom. The company law doesn't quite match. French company law is not the same as English company law, it's not the same as German company law, and so on. So the European Union tries to harmonise. And in all these areas, we see harmonisation going on to create a single market. So we see harmonisation of company law, harmonisation of competition law, harmonisation of employment law, public procurement law, intellectual property rights protection, consumer protection, and so on. They're all areas of our law which get in the way of free movement. Free movement of people, free movement of goods, of services, and of capital. So those areas of law are areas in which European law is present. And when a student studies company law at university, they will do a bit of European law. When they study employment law, they do a little bit of European law as well. Because European law comes in and influences these bodies of law in every country. That is, it's the most developed bit of the European Union. When we study European Union law at university, that's the sort of substantive stuff we get our teeth into. The rest is a little bit more removed from normal legal practice. Of course, if you're a farmer, the common agricultural policy is really significant. I think it's something like half of farmers' incomes in this country are derived from the common agricultural policy. About 40% of the EU's budget is redistributed through the common agricultural policy. So the contributions we make get given back in the form of subsidies to make sure that the food production in the EU is enough and not too much. Food is not subject to a free market. It's too important. Common fisheries policy, similar sort of thing. Regulatory system to make sure that we don't fish the stocks out of existence, and they weren't really fished out of existence 20 years ago, but at the same time that we maintain as much livelihood of fishermen as we can. The EU looks after public health and food safety. Increasingly, food safety requirements, public health requirements are European derived. Environmental protection, relatively new but really important area of EU competence. I'll come back to environmental protection briefly later on. It's got an emerging energy policy. It's trying there to make sure that the whole of the European Union area has access to energy which is reliable, reasonably cheap, and also environmentally sustainable. It has a transport policy to secure transport networks across the whole European area. Regional development. Regional development is the word we use for money in the EU. What actually goes on here under regional development is the allocation of funds to those parts of the European Union that are poor. So if you look at the economy of Cornwall, for example, most of you will know that the economy of Cornwall is not in great shape if you look at it individually. Apart from tourism and a bit of fishing, there isn't much. A lot of the income that's coming in is coming in through EU funds, regional development funds. That will be true across the European Union. About 40 to 50% of the EU budget is spent on regional development. And then there's a certain amount on research and education. You may have heard of the Erasmus scheme. We had an exam board today in the law school. We were processing some Erasmus students, and we were wondering whether the scheme would be with us in a week's time or not, because almost certainly if we leave, the first thing to go will be the Erasmus scheme. That was the experience elsewhere. Now, Katie mentioned that under Maastricht, the EU started taking on some competences, attempts to coordinate policy in a wider number of areas. What we see is an increasing concern for cross-border law enforcement within the European Union. The European Union promotes judicial cooperation in criminal and civil justice. You may have heard of the European Arrest Warrant, for example. That's an example of judicial cooperation in criminal justice. It's increasingly trying to secure police cooperation. Why? Because it's trying to get hold of terrorism and organised crime. And there's quite a strand of work now within the European Union trying to deal with things like human trafficking, to do with drug trade, and other forms of organised crime. All part of its internal security strategy. And finally, the European Union manages external relations. The European Union acts collectively vis-à-vis the rest of the world. So it maintains a common trade policy. The deal with which, let's say, Nigeria trades with us is the same for the whole of the European Union. It engages in humanitarian assistance around the world, dealing with natural disasters, man-made disasters. It promotes sustainable development in various ways around the world, and also governance reform. This idea of governance reform is very important in the Eastern European countries, particularly those that aspire to join the European Union at some point. So the key there is to develop democracy, develop the rule of law, develop government institutions that are robust and match the sort of political standards that we expect. There is economic and monetary union. We're not part of that, but it goes on over there. Not much time to talk about that now. The Eurozone. And finally, the EU runs itself. If you, just some figures there, 6% of the EU's budget is spent on administration, and that's spent in employing about 33,000 civil servants in the European Commission, 6,000 in Parliament, and 3,500 in the Council of Ministers. I'm told that's roughly the size of public employment in Leeds City Council, I'm told. More to the point, it's about 1% of the size of the British civil service per head of population. So the British civil service is per head of population 100 times bigger than the European Union staff. So it gives you a sense of the scale. It's actually quite a small organisation. 33,000, 40,000 might sound like a lot of people, but actually it isn't when you compare it with most national civil services. It's quite a small organisation, mostly in Brussels and in a few other towns. That's me for now. I think it's over to Ed.
We've been talking a lot about competences, and one of my competences is not maths, that's my GCSE. So this is clearly what I could give at this subject. How much does the EU cost? And we'll know that this is one of the areas that has been most controversial in the referendum campaign, with different people using different figures to make different points. And these figures from the Treasury illustrate that. They've been used by all parties, so clearly all parties think these figures are worth using and reliable. They've just tended to use them in slightly different ways. So, for instance, the figure that that has been used quite a lot by the Leave campaign has been a £350 million per week saving if we leave the EU. And that is from the middle column at the top, that £361 million a week of the gross contribution we make as a country to the EU, which they say will come back to us and be able to be spent on a whole lot of very exciting things. Now, the reason that's been such a controversial figure is that doesn't include the rebates that Margaret Thatcher famously won for us in the 80s, money we get back having paid it to Europe. So there's actually money that Margaret Thatcher sort of staked a huge amount of political capital on getting that money back. And once you've taken that rebate, the amount of money we give the EU week, each week becomes something around, says Her Majesty's Treasury, we would hope they would know, £276 million a week. But then to get a more accurate figure, you probably need to then, as it were, minus the things we get back in other ways. So minus our public sector receipts, our stuff that Europe contributes to our public sector, and then also minus the private sector receipts, the things the EU pays for in the private sector in the UK. And then you potentially get a more fair representation of, as it were, what the EU costs us. Although, of course, all these figures are controversial things. And that means that there's potentially a figure around about 161 million a week that produces that figure of about 8 billion a year that, as it were, the EU takes from us. Okay? And that's probably one of the figures that's more reliable. And that is a figure that is used by both sides. Some, so the Remain side say it's not very much at all. The Leave side saying, think of what you could do with 8 billion. Which if you're bored for any part of the rest of the EU, that might be something you want to do. What can you do with that 8 billion pounds? You might want to compare some of those figures with what we're spending on other things. This is UK public expenditure 2015-16, the sort of things we are paying for and the sort of figures associated with that. Again, show that a lot of the EU money, as it were, the money we give to the EU, is relative small fry in the big scheme of things. Okay? That is a little bit of input on the matter level why some people failed their messaging system. Take it or leave it. What I want us to do, just for a few moments now, is perhaps just sort of, just turn, and you've got to get a bit of interaction going, just turn to somebody sitting there, just perhaps talk about one thing that surprised you, one new thing you have learned so far from the excitement that has already been this evening. So one thing that you have learned so far, so tell us about the parents. What we're going to do now is just allow a little bit of time for any questions on anything that's been said so far. Please no detailed questions about the financial figures, I might cry. But any questions about the sort of the history of the EU, what the EU does, that we can answer at this point. Anybody got a question? If you've got a question, raise your hand and we will endeavour to answer it. So right at the back, Matt, do you want to shout out?
Yeah, you might not know. Whether we had a figure of more sense of our budget going forward, our top
So what percentage of our income goes on our civil service was the question. Sitting down at their feet, that would be the sort of thing, unless anybody knows, this is the situation to show off. Quite impressive, if you didn't have attended. But that would be something we're looking at, working on later. Thank you. Just so we get a comparison. Okay, any other questions? Chris?
Yeah, so, are you able to tell us to what extent decision makers in the EU are in some way democratically elected?
To what extent are the decision makers in the EU democratically elected? Do you want to go for this, Julian?
The European Commission is not. It's appointed either, the commissioners are appointed by governments, so they're public appointees, and the commission, as I said, civil service is just their employees. The democratic legitimacy comes through the fact that the governments we elect are represented in the Council of Ministers, and that we elect members to the European Parliament. There is, I think, a problem with democracy. We're getting into critique here. Clearly, there's what's called the democratic deficit, and we might have a chance to talk about that in the discussion. The way that the EU is democratically legitimated is not the same and isn't as extensive as the way a national government or a national parliament is democratically legitimated. That's certainly the case. On the other hand, it's much more democratically legitimated than any other international organisation. So international organisations tend to represent the views of the governments, so they're only indirectly. So to what extent is the United Nations a democratic body? Well, not at all, but for the fact it contains representatives of governments that have, at least in democratic countries, been democratically elected. So the EU hovers halfway between something like the UN, which is really not democratically connected at all, it simply represents governments, and a national government and a national parliament, which is much more closely democratically legitimate, sort of halfway house.
Next question from Nicholas Brown.
Julian, you say that the people who are deciding the laws of the park, not who are voting on them, but the people who are approving them, are not democratically elected.
So that was a question about the people actually proposing laws aren't democratically elected, is that right?
That's correct, and the same is true in this country.
Can you say a bit more about that?
Politicians don't draft laws, civil servants draft laws.
But who proposes them? That's my question. Well,
At which point are we going to turn to what you've all come for, which is, first of all, a case to remain, and then a case to leave. Is it worth saying that these cases don't necessarily reflect personal viewpoints? These are us trying to, as it were, give the best case, particularly from a Christian point of view, as to why we should remain or why we should leave. And on the remain side,
so again, I'll try and be fairly brief with this. The Christian case for Remain really starts with the history of the European Union. After two world wars, Europe was in ruins, not just in terms of infrastructure and economies, but in terms of political ideology, it was in ruins. Both National Socialism and Communism had failed. And into that vacuum, in the late 1940s and early 1950s, stepped Christian democracy. The Christian democracy is a political movement that is familiar in continental Europe, but not familiar in the United Kingdom, because it's largely based on Catholic social thought, which has been less developed or less obvious in the UK. Although actually, in practice, there were also very many Protestant Christian Democrats. The core beliefs of Catholic social thought and of Christian democracy are, I think, three things. Firstly, they stood on the freedom and dignity of the individual. So that idea was expressed most notably in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which again, strongly influenced by Christian democratic thought. Second precept of Christian democracy is the importance of strong and independent social institutions. such as families, churches, schools and universities, professional associations, trade unions, and voluntary groups. And then the third element is a commitment to care for the poor, economic equity, and social welfare. So you have a blend there of a political approach, which we actually associate both with the left wing and the right wing. It's not left wing in the sense it doesn't believe in a big state. It believes in a strong civil society, strong social institutions. But it is, if you like, left wing in that it cares about relative wealth and poverty and redistribution. On the other hand, it looks a bit right wing in that it cares a lot about the freedom of the individual and the dignity of the individual, but notice that it doesn't care about wealth maximization and economic liberty in quite the same way as a typical right-wing politician might today. So here we have a particular ideology that becomes very strong in continental Europe in the aftermath of the Second World War. The founders of the European communities were almost all Christian Democrats. Most of them were practicing Catholics. In fact, it was so obvious and so well known that jokes were made about it. There were one or two exceptions, but most of the founders were Christian Democrats, and they were determined to build Europe around ideals that they felt grew out of their Christian democracy. They cared about solidarity, and by solidarity they understood the concern that we should have for the other, and particularly for the one who is weak, that we have something in common as human beings. That's what love for neighbour requires. So there was a concern for solidarity among the peoples of Europe. There was a concern for subsidiarity. The idea that you should only take decisions high up at state level if they can't be taken low down at grassroots level. There's, if you like, a drift in power downwards. Subsidiarity actually has become an official principle of the European Union. Questionable whether they managed to achieve it or not, but the aspiration is still there that decisions should be taken as close to the grassroots as possible. But the third feature of the founders was an explicit religious and moral vision. They recognized that Europe had become morally bankrupt in the context of the early 20th century, and they wanted to reaffirm Europe's Christian heritage and try and build some political structures that could express that Christian concern for each other, a concern for peace, a concern for economic equity, for sharing, for welfare, and for economic growth. So we have among the founders of the EU a really very obvious, in their own terms, very explicit Christian commitment. And they saw their little project, this little community they were building, this experiment in international cooperation, as an expression of that Christian belief. Now, all the Christian writers I've read who support staying in the European Union, want to stay in the European Union, seem to agree that something at some point went wrong. And I think, as far as I can tell, most of them would agree that the problem gets crystallized around about Maastricht, around about this Treaty of Maastricht that Katie told us about in 1991, where the relatively low-level, pragmatic, single-market project gets turned into an enormous political project. A project of building an explicit union. It's not dying yet. An explicit a political union, which does all sorts of things that actually were perhaps overambitious. Trying to introduce EU citizenship, trying to deal with foreign affairs and security, trying to get involved in managing justice and home affairs in domestic contexts, trying to do the Euro project, European Monetary Union. And a number of Christian writers that I've read point out that this has really taken the European Union away from its original moral and Christian vision to a political economic vision, a vision of market capitalism where you get a combination of the state and the market working together to maximize national wealth, and really has lost sight of the original founding vision of human flourishing, human well-being. So the global wealth becomes an end in itself, and you see that then in countries like Greece, where you have unemployment running at 50%, you have half of pensioners below the minimum wage, but they're locked into the euro. And they have, you know, has to, the euro project can't fail, and so Greece can suffer as a result of getting that economic project off the ground. I think the original founding members would have said that is not equitable, that's not just, that's not showing concern for human well-being. What's really ironic is that round about the same time as Maastricht, Jacques Delors, you may remember, was president of the European Commission, launched an initiative called the Soul for Europe. He famously said this, it was a speech to churches in Brussels in February 92. If in the next 10 years we haven't managed to give a soul to Europe, to give it spirituality and meaning, the game will be up. Delors was also very much influenced by his upbringing in Roman Catholicism and Catholic personalism. He saw that the EU was drifting off in a direction that was actually contrary to Christian spiritual and ethical values, and tried to do something about it. The net effect of this initiative was that there was a formal dialogue and consultation process with church representatives in Brussels, and it's now enshrined in the treaties as well. You might think that was a rather minor outcome of an important idea. But pro-Europe Christians, pro-EU Christians would claim that the vision, the original vision, is still an attractive one, and it's important that we stay in the EU in order to try to recover that vision. So it's not staying in the EU for the sake of staying in, it's staying in order to try to rebuild the original Christian vision. So at its most basic level, I think those who argue that we should stay in point out that we can't secure peace between the nations of Europe simply through a military alliance, simply through NATO. The experience of the 20th century is you need economic interdependency if you're going to secure peace. So that's one reason for staying in. I think they would want to point out that we face serious collective problems in Europe, problems of right-wing nationalism, problems of terrorism, problems of large-scale migration, problems of environmental damage, and we aren't going to be able to address those on an individual basis. If you try to address problems like, for example, environmental problems on a country-by-country basis, it simply doesn't work. The national self-interest is too strong. You need a model for collective agreement. Now, there are lots of faults, but I think one area in which EU action has led the way globally is in this area of environmental protection. And there are all sorts of models. You think of there's the carbon trading system, the emissions trading system, which is a system Europe-wide whereby you can effectively buy and sell your right to generate carbon dioxide. It's a way of keeping greenhouse gases down. That's often held up as a very good example of successful environmental action, which can't be achieved without a structure, something like the EU. People also point to overseas aid and development as an important area of EU action. But I think the most important point that the pro-EU Christian writers have made, that I've read, is that the debate in this country has been unacceptably self-interested. It's been focused purely on the interests of the UK. The question has not been asked, how should Europe be governed? And then, what is the role of the UK in that process of governance? The UK still has enormous moral and diplomatic authority across the world. It's quite remarkable what authority it has. It also politically contributes a certain a set of values and principles to the European process which are unique. It is probably, we're probably the most individualistic country in the European Union. We're probably the most liberal, the most free market, liberal in the sense of caring about individual freedoms. And that is valued by a lot of people in the European Union who sit in the political middle. We might also make a point that the EU also has a restraining effect on British politics as well, preventing it, we could say, from being perhaps more American. Now, I want to close with a quotation from Justin Welby. You may have, this was well trailed in the news. Archbishop Justin Welby said this a few days ago in his reflections on the EU referendum debate, and I think he is coming from a similar sort of Christian perspective as the original founders. Sacrifice, generosity, vision beyond self-interest, suffering for others, helping the helpless. These are some of the deeply Christian principles that have shaped us. They are principles that show us at our best, as an example to other countries, as a home of freedom and democracy, as a beacon of hope that shines around a dark world. I hope and pray that the result will be reached with the aim to be a good Britain in a good Europe, whether as part of the EU or not, but then he went on, with all due portion as Archbishop, to say that in his view, we are more likely to be able to achieve some of those values by staying in than by leaving. That's a case for Remain. It's now up to Ed to put the other side of the argument.
Okay, at some point the EU flag might fall down. Don't take that as a sort of prophecy in any way, shape, or form. Just come unstuck. Okay, a case to leave. I've got five biblical truths that might or could encourage you to put your cross in the leave box next week. The first reason would be this, that from a biblical perspective, nations matter. Nations matter. National diversity, ethnic diversity, different cultures seem to be something that God looks at in the world that he created and he thinks it is good. The uniformity of a European superstate is hard to reconcile with some parts of the Bible. Genesis 10 at the table of nations, and it seems to be something the Bible writers are celebrating, that we've become a whole, the human kind of become a whole lot of nations. There's also talk in Acts 7:26 of God making every nation of man, of there being his idea, something that he has made happen in the world today. And of course the vision the Bible ends with is a vision of loads of different nations and tribes and peoples gathered around God's throne, and then still being distinct nations and tribes and peoples gathered around his throne. So if we think that the Christian answer must be everybody's we're getting together, one big having family, and all distinctions tripping away, that isn't necessarily the case. Nations matter. Which means that this quote from an MEP and a former Belgian Prime Minister might not be as Christian as it first seems. A Europe of nations is a relic of the past. Actually, we might have, in the new creation, nations. We make up around the throne. So the end of nationhood, not necessarily a Christian idea. Nations matter to God. First reason, they believe. Second reason would be just this. How corrupt. How corrupt. There's a great quote from Lord Acton, which you might have come across before. Power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. How do we cope with that? How do we cope with the reality that that is borne out in history again and again and again? When you give people too much power, it corrupts them. It's a biblical truth, isn't it, that we've seen at Emmanuel's, we've looked at some of the leaders of God's people back in the Old Testament. Something we're going to see as we look at the lives of King David and of King Saul. King Solomon, all of them were corrupted by power. How have humans sought to sort of read their Bibles and recognize that and make sure that the power doesn't corrupt people and nations? Well, they sought to limit it. They sought to put in democratic checks and balances on national leaders. And Europe lacks them massively. Let me just illustrate that. I know that only 37% of people in the southwest of England voted in the last European elections. You may or may not have been among that percentage. Who here can name one of the southwest's MEPs? Okay, we're going to have some names shouted out. I'm just going to see how we do. So if you know an MEP in the southwest name, you want to shout out. I'm going to see if we can get a full house.
William Miller Dartmouth.
Anybody else? Bermudy, thank you. Anybody else? So, to illustrate potentially a point, out of six names that we can come up with, the people that are represented in Brussels, we only need two. Thank you. That's not the case, probably for the Westminster Parliament, because there's that individual link, isn't there, between a constituency MP and a constituency. That's been lost in the EU. I would point out earlier that EU commissioners are appointed by national governments. Who knows the name of the British commissioner? asked John Davis this recently, he went to Lynn Britton in the 1890s. we're talking about today, do you know? Lord Hill. I think it's Lord Hill. Jonathan Hill was never been elected to anything in his life. So not even at the House of Commons. So, common argument, there's a democratic deficit in the EU, and I'd like to say from a Christian point of view, we could say in response to that that is dangerous, because power corrupts. And if you don't have checks and balances, you head into trouble. Third case, or third reason, political reason to vote to leave the EU. Communities care. Care of those in need, obedience to this command, in the Bible, I think it's most meant to happen at a family and at a local level as part of Christian discipleship. The Old Testament famously encourages the welcoming of strangers and foreigners by families and local communities. Many people, many Christians who oppose EU membership would say that the best way of welcoming and assimilating genuine asylum seekers from around the world would be to encourage the crisis to be bottom up rather than top down. Quotas from Brussels, but actually local communities getting involved. We need local communities working together to sponsor and integrate those who have been really unsafe elsewhere, not the mass economic migration that the EU bureaucracy has powered to stop and which is fueling ideas around both. Communities care best. We can have a lot of Christians with it. Not anti-migration, but wanting migration, as it were, to be driven most of all by local communities, families, churches, rather than an international superstate. Fourth reason why the Bible might encourage us to leave the EU. Money serves. Money is meant to serve people. And we probably all found that the most persuasive arguments, the most, as it were, worrying arguments, the arguments that have been going around our head from the Remain campaign are all the economic arguments. There's been a huge number of economic, as it were, scare tactics. And just need to recognise that a lot of the Remain arguments have been in economic terms. A good question might be that we might want to ask tonight, is that Christian? Is it Christian to be driven so much by money, to be frightened by quotes like this? Leaving the EU is the biggest domestic risk for financial stability. That makes sense, doesn't it? That makes sense. Now, obviously, economic prosperity is important. The Bible clearly encourages it. But does it encourage us to make every decision on the basis of economics? Or should we remember this Bible verse? The love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. And if we've been driven just by the thoughts of money, we might end up in a bad place. Money is not there to serve people. It's there to serve people. Not to depend on everything people do. A fifth value, honesty matters. A famous quote from the Bible, one of the Ten Commandments, you should not give false testimony against your neighbour. You could say that the most honest European leaders make it clear that ever close union is still on the cards, and that they are not breaking the commandments, but that our national leaders are breaking the commandments as they pretend that the high watermark of European integration has passed as gone. And you could argue, that as a nation we should be honest in saying that we don't want to be part of the European superstates, and that we should take the advice of the very wise man. Francois Hollande, President of France. If you don't want the strengthening of Europe, there is only one way. The only way possible for those who are not convinced of Europe is to leave Europe. Perhaps you might take up the advice. End of the case to leave. Thank you for your attention. Again. Anything persuasive you've heard, turn to your neighbour. What's the most persuasive thing you've heard from those who earlier? What we're going to do now is we're going to have a bit of a focus on two of the big issues.
to the issues we've heard sort of talked about again and again, to the words, the buzzwords of the referendum campaign: sovereignty and immigration. And we're going to have 10 minutes on each. First of all, Julian, on, I'm hoping, sovereignty. And you can say two.
There will be time for lots of questions and discussion. We thought rather than breaking now for questions and discussion, we'd get through the stuff, and then we've got a bit more time at the end. So my brief was to say a few words about sovereignty, because I think it's one of those big topics that a lot of people worry about. You know, why should we leave the EU? Well, we should leave the EU in order to get our sovereignty back. Sovereignty matters. And of course, sovereignty is an expression of democratic self-determination. It's an expression of being an independent nation. It's about some of the things that Ed was talking about, making sure that power is kept down and doesn't conglomerate up in some great big super state. But what exactly is sovereignty? I would suggest that there are three ideas here that get confused in a number of people's minds, but not, I'm sure, in yours, and certainly not in a few minutes' time. The first idea of sovereignty is, sometimes when we talk about sovereignty, we mean ultimate constitutional authority. For any state, or any political unit, or actually any group of people, even a church, or a school, has some sort of ultimate source of power. There's some point where the buck stops. And in a democratic state, that is the people expressing their will through their constitution. And that is, it's very clear that ultimate constitutional authority in the EU rests with each individual member state. There's no doubt about that. Once upon a time, 1972, the UK decided to join. And now we're wondering about whether to leave. The fact that we are having this debate and exercising this choice shows that ultimate constitutional authority rests with us. If we decide to go, we can. If we decide to stay, we can do that. That's why we're having a referendum. Now, in fact, it's the German Constitutional Court that has done more than any other court in the EU to define the significance of this ultimate constitutional authority. The German Constitutional Court has said that there are legal limits, constitutional limits, to the amount of European integration the German government can sign up to. It does not have the right, under the Constitution, to give away too much German authority. One of the interesting conundrums of the future is that the logic of the euro is pointing to a degree of political integration which the German Constitutional Court will not allow the German government to sign up to. This is an unresolved problem. And major problem, who knows what happened, whether we're in or out, how they'll resolve that, because Germany, of course, is the biggest backer of the key financial backer of the euro. When it comes to ultimate constitutional authority, there is no loss of sovereignty. We have it, and so does each individual member state. Secondly, sometimes when we talk about sovereignty, we mean legal supremacy. Now, in areas where the European Union has legal competence, its law is supreme. Logically, it has to be. You can't have a system of lawmaking, which is what the EU is, which is supposed to bind all the member states, and then allow an individual member state to say, actually, we don't like that one. We'll do something else. That would destroy the system. The logic of the system is that where the EU has the power to make law, that law is supreme, and domestic law takes second place. So if you have a conflict between an act of parliament and the European regulation takes precedence. In that sense, sovereignty has been lost, quite clearly. We have lost sovereignty in all those areas in which the European Union has made law. And if we leave the European Union, we would regain that sovereignty. Because once again, Parliament would become the supreme legislative body, and we could have the final say on what gets made law. In that sense, it is true to say that if we leave the EU, we will regain our sovereignty. However, thirdly, sometimes when we talk about sovereignty, what we mean is political independence. That's the question of how far a country is free to pass its own laws, free in practice, free as a matter of political and moral reality. Parliament, under traditional UK constitutional doctrine, can make any law it likes. That's legally correct. Parliament can pass any law it likes. But morally and politically, Parliament can't pass any law it likes. It would be impossible. There are all sorts of things that Parliament cannot do without causing a major political crisis, or without doing something which is so morally mad that the vast majority of MPs wouldn't sign up to it. We live in an interconnected world, a world in which it's increasingly difficult to do whatever we like at the level of national policy. There are real practical constraints we live under, and that's the question of sovereignty as political independence. My worry is that when people talk about sovereignty, they confuse number two with number three. They think that by regaining legal supremacy, the ability to make laws, the final say, you somehow build political independence, freedom of action. And that's simply not true. The two issues are quite separate. The real question of sovereignty is, how much political independence do we have within the EU, and how much do we have out of it? Would we have out of it? And that's a much harder question to answer. I'm going to try and make a few suggestions as to how we might go about answering it, but obviously there's a lot more to be said. I want to start with some interesting research done by King's College London. Some researchers had a look at the voting patterns in the Council of Ministers, the government representatives who agreed to EU law, and they tried to work out how often is the UK in a minority? How often does the UK lose a vote in the Council of Ministers? If you like, that's a test of political independence, isn't it? Up to 2009, they found that the UK lost 2.6% of the time. A tiny amount. In 97.4% of the votes, the UK voted with the majority. They got the laws, we got the laws we wanted out of the European Union. After 2009, there was a steady change. You have to work out what happened soon after 2009 in terms of which government came into power. The UK has now gone to the top of the table. It's lost 12.3% of the votes. Put that another way, we win 7 out of 8. 7 out of 8 votes that are taken in Council of Ministers, we get the laws we want. 1 time out of 8, we don't. And we can even track the areas in which we tend to win and the areas in which we tend to lose. We tend to vote against the majority on issues of budget, how much the EU gets, money, on foreign and security policy, on international development. We tend to vote with the majority on international trade, matters of industry, environment, transport, legal affairs, economic and monetary union, although we're not part of it, and internal market policies. So we can begin to see there are certain pinch points where the UK is not getting, we're not getting, if you like, nationally, what we would like out of the EU. In addition to this question of political independence, you have to take account of growing flexibility or variable geometry within the EU. To start with, it was believed that everyone had to sign up to exactly the same laws and policies. Over the years, that has broken down, and there was more and more option for having your own package, if you like, within the European Union. We call that flexibility or variable geometry. So one of the first instances was this so-called Schengen Agreement, where 5 of the then 10 member states, it was in 1985, 5 of the 10 member states agreed to do away with border controls. The other 5 did not. That's variable geometry, flexibility. The Economic and Monetary Union, obvious example, not every member state is a member of the Euro. There's another example of flexibility. And of course, David Cameron tried to do a deal and came back with a deal which people didn't really think much of, in which he got commitments in 4 further areas. Particularly, I think this is the most interesting, he got a clear statement agreed from the Commission that the UK is not committed to further integration in the European Union. Now, lots of things can happen over the years, but there's a sense in which it's now accepted at the highest level in the EU that the UK is not committed to further integration. So the ever closer union point is not necessarily one we should assume will take place. So there's something about how independent are we within the European Union. The other question is, how independent are we outside of the European Union? And there, the question is, well, what sort of a deal will we get? And there's been a lot of stuff on that in the news and on the media. We don't know. We don't know what sort of deal. We're going to get a deal. There's no doubt about that, because the EU cannot afford not to trade with us, and we can't afford not to trade with the EU. There will have to be some sort of an arrangement. But what will that look like? 3 options seem to be discussed. There's the Norway option, the Switzerland option, and the Canada option. The Norway option is not very attractive at all. Basically, Norway is a member of what's now called the European Economic Area, it used to be the European Free Trade Association, EFTA, because Norway voted no in its referendums. So it's not part of the EU, but in order to get access to the market to sell its goods and to buy goods, it's had to sign up to basically the whole package of existing common market laws. So it gets all the same laws and all the same rules, but it has no say in their drafting. This is why most Brexit advocates have not held up Norway as a good model. So there's the Swiss model. Well, the Swiss model is to do a whole series of bilateral treaties. So you take each topic in turn and you negotiate an agreement. It's taken a very, 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 very long time for Switzerland to get through this process, but it's got there, and it has pretty much signed up to everything in the single market, including the free movement of workers. So then you have the Canada model, or maybe we have the Canada model, and here we're in new territory because the EU is only just beginning to work out a comprehensive trade and economic agreement with Canada, and this will see the abolition of most tariff barriers, so the obstacles on goods coming in and out, and services coming in and out, but a number of regulatory barriers remain in place. So the standards that you apply, let's say, to the production of electrical goods will be different in the EU from Canada, but there will be free movement to trade those goods across the boundary. And it's the Canada model that I think most Brexit advocates would like us to move towards. But notice that this would be really very unusual. There's no European equivalent, there's no country we can look to in the European area and say that's the sort of relationship we like. That would give us sufficient political independence. But I think the question of political independence is the one we should focus on, and we should think very carefully about how much freedom we have in the EU in practice and how much freedom we have outside of it. That's enough, I think, on sovereignty. The last topic of all, Katie comes back to close off with immigration, and then we'll be into discussion and questions.
The next 10 minutes, I'm going to ask Katie a little bit on immigration. Before we talk about immigration, we really need to understand what we mean by immigration. The government classifies a migrant as somebody who's here for 1 year or more. There's a whole host of reasons why they're not here, such as for work, for study, to join their families, and a whole host of others. So why is immigration relevant to the EU debate? Well, as Julian mentioned, and the free movement of people is central to the European single market. You can't have a single market without accepting free movement of people. And that's why it's such an important issue. It's not something we can just tell the EU you don't really want to be a part of that anymore. So why do we discuss it now? Why are we focusing on it? Well, it does seem to have been an issue which has been really major upon in the referendum debate for some time, and it's actually a very decisive issue for some. So, yeah, as I said, the next 10 minutes will focus our attention on migration of EU citizens into the UK rather than UK citizens out into Europe, because that seems to be the biggest issue and the central issue to the immigration debate that's happening now. My plan is to look briefly at the figures and then the cost to the UK of the EU migrants, and then we'll consider how staying or leaving might affect EU immigration. But the short answer is we don't know. And then just very briefly wrap up with how being a Christian might affect our understanding and thinking on the issue of immigration. So first, the figures. There are currently around 3.3 million EU citizens here in the UK, and there are currently around 1.2 million UK citizens in other EU countries. That leaves us, the mathematicians, with a surplus of 2.2 million people in this country. And those figures are taken from the very imprecise, if you want to laugh, look it up, Government International Passenger Survey. Essentially, they just mark every 10th person who's on the ferry to ask them if they're staying for a year or more. Apparently, it's quite accurate, so I don't really see how it works, but I'm not in comment. So the average EU net migration to the UK, no, sorry, the figure for net migration to the UK 2015 was 184,000 people, and that tends to be the average number over the preceding 3 or 4 years as well. The average age of an EU migrant is just 26, and the average net contribution to the state of an EU migrant is £6,000 a head per annum. Now, actually, I think that figure is quite an important figure. So what do we mean by that, the average contribution to the state? Well, what we mean is that the average EU migrant contributes £6,000 more per year in taxes to the state than what they take out in terms of public services such as the NHS. That's actually an incredibly good figure when you consider the fact that EU migrants tend to be lower-paid workers in general, 60% of lower-paid workers. That's quite a huge proportion of their salary which they're contributing. And that as a UK, we're running at a deficit. So everybody here is actually taking out more, on average, from the state than what they're contributing in taxes. So the fact that EU migrants are contributing more is an incredibly positive thing. Obviously, when you look at the UK figures, you are taking into account different ages and stages, whereas the UK migrant, EU migrants does tend to be more around that lower age bracket, so they're not such a drain, I hate to use the word, on resources such as the NHS. The number of children in schools, and obviously there are issues there. So the employment rate of the EU migrants is at 79.4%. That's higher than the employment rates of UK nationals, that rate being around 74%. What are the other 20.6% of people that aren't in employment? Well, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're claiming benefits. We certainly shouldn't be jumping to that conclusion, as a number of newspapers have. They could be people working at home mums. We have a number of those in our church even, so if you look at the demographic, and family dependents, and go some way to extend that. So the cost to the UK of EU migrants. Essentially, do they come here and steal our jobs? No, they don't. And it's actually a very false economy to suggest that migrants are stealing our jobs, and there's a number of reasons why that is so. Very, very summarised, the main reasons are, first, economic migrants are tend to be coming here to look for economic opportunities, jobs. And so they tend to choose locations where jobs are readily available, or they create jobs by being self-employed, or higher skilled workers tend to bring jobs with them and employ people. Second, they often fill gaps. We have a very high welfare state in this country. I don't need to admit it. That's been runs around. But we have a number of native workers, quite a high number of native workers, who will choose to stay unemployed and be on the welfare state than take a repetitive low-skilled jobs. And please don't take me as casting any judgment on that. I don't. The reality of the situation is that our welfare state can make it very difficult for people to work because they could lose money rather than being on the welfare state. And there's lots of personal circumstances that make that difficult. However, when we're looking at EU migrants, they are actually often willing to accept those jobs and fill gaps. They wouldn't be receiving as much benefit. That issue is not there as much. Migrants also fill gaps on higher skilled end, such as areas of research and technology. They come here with valuable experience that we haven't got in the UK, and they bring valuable knowledge with them. And currently, it's a common at Dyson. I don't necessarily share his views that were in the media, but a few years back, actually, he said something quite interesting. For Dyson, obviously, one of the main issues in their business is the IP that they own. And he said, if our immigration policy really doesn't make very much sense, and he wasn't talking about EU immigration, of course, and he said, they come here, they work with us for a couple of years, they bring us valuable knowledge, and they take away valuable knowledge, and all of our trade secrets home with them because we make them leave. And obviously, that's not happening currently with EU migrants. The third reason why they don't come and take our jobs is because immigrants as consumers increase demand for goods and services. The higher demand, in turn, affects the labour market, therefore creating more jobs and reducing demand for labour. So, sound economics shows that instead of trying to take our jobs, migrants often complement native workers or accept jobs that natives can't or don't want to do. What do they contribute to our economy? Well, as we've already just touched on, they tend to boost employment in the long term. Working people boost our economy by creating consumer demand and contributing to our economy in, by way of taxes. What do they receive by way of welfare? We've already touched on that. On average, they're contributing £6,000 more than they take away. But what are the real costs of immigration and particularly EU migration? And is it really a problem? The answer is yes, it's a problem with infrastructure. And the infrastructure costs associated with the rising number of the population is actually worrying. The country here is not built to deal with the growing number of people. Housing shortages, roads, public services such as transport, new places in schools, beds in hospitals, all these are real key issues when we're looking at the issue of migration and of population growth in the country. Those costs aren't actually taken into consideration when we're looking at migrant figures and their contribution, and it really is those that represent the real problem in the UK today. It's a space issue, an infrastructure issue. So, what might the effect of remaining in the EU have on migration? The answer is it's unknown, and obviously probably not a lot. The deal that David Cameron struck with the EU discussed a plan to increase the thresholds for migrants claiming benefits. Now, we know that not many migrants are actually coming here from the EU to claim benefits. They're coming here to work. But the government still negotiated with the EU that new arrivals won't be able to claim tax credits and other welfare payments straight away if they're able to now, but they'll gradually gain the rights to more benefits the longer they stay here. And that's the rate yet to be undecided. Which may be a disincentive to people who do want to come here solely to claim benefits. He also negotiated a child benefits reform. At the moment, migrant workers can receive child benefits to send home and to their home countries. But those in the future should be staying in the EU. It's suggested that they'll be capped at a level reflecting the actual cost of living in the home country rather than just the blanket rate which we apply at the moment. We may also see a levelling as the Eastern EU economies grow. This is disputed, but there's some suggestion that we might see this levelling off. Last year, Eastern economies grew faster than Western ones, so it might not be that the number is ever increasing. The effect of leaving the EU on immigration, again, it's unknown. Vote Leave actually, just this week, said something quite interesting, which said that their intention, obviously, is not to stop migration, and the long-term net figure is unlikely to change. However, they'd like migration to be more focused on UK needs rather than just the free movement of people. Leave believes that, as I said, long-term figures won't be affected. What might happen is we might see an increase in non-EU migrants over EU migrants should we leave the EU. There may also be initially what I've called a surge in the stay. So if we choose to leave the EU, and before that leave is accepted, we may see a surge of people coming in. We may not see a surge of people coming in to just make the most of the fact that they can come in now, rather than having to do an application in the system later on. And also the EU migrants that are currently in the country who are not intending to stay as long, they might move around, they might actually decide to stay rather than moving back home because they won't then have the option necessarily to come back here freely. So we might initially see a boost in the numbers, but as we said, it's unknown. How might we tackle migration if we leave the EU? Well, as Julian suggested, there are a number of models. There's the Norway Swiss option, which I've banded together, but actually Swiss falls under the bilateral point there. So the Norway option, have access to the single market, even though we're not EU members. Part of that deal is the free movement of people, so not much will change. Bilateral Swiss, the Swiss option, making bilateral treaties on migration with EU in the member states. Now, this is not true for all the decisions that we might want to make bilaterally, but for immigration, at the moment, any decision that we make on immigration would likely require ratification by all member states, because EU law has a say on the volumes of admission of non-EU economic migrants to the member states. So basically, we can make these decisions bilaterally, but at the end of the day, the EU is likely to have to ratify it, and we probably end up with something fairly blanket across the board. And we could also impose the same restrictions as we do for non-EU migrants. That could have a significant cut to the EU net migration in the UK. 60% of non-EU migrants are low-skilled pay, and they wouldn't meet the threshold that we have at the moment for entry into the UK. However, it would then likely mean no access to the single market, which is likely at least initially to have a negative effect on our economy, and then have a negative effect on all the things that we're worrying about infrastructure and costs and jobs and things like that. So, very much in brief, how might the Christian effect of thinking on EU migration and immigration? Now, Ed discussed earlier about thinking about our neighbour, and we have some thoughts on that. I think the first and most central issue is that we really need to have our facts right. The law requires us to judge fairly in making our decisions, and therefore it's very important that we know the facts and we're not simply led and fooled by believing statistics which shock us and make an ill-informed decision. Secondly, the Jubilee Centre has a very useful handout on immigration, and that highlights that really we should be pursuing loving kindness and not just purely justice. And as part of that, it also encourages churches to get involved with social policy, to have their doors open, to be a key in the community to accepting those who are immigrants, and to really love our neighbour. I think here we are given a real gift and a responsibility to consider and influence the impact of staying or leaving the most vulnerable people around us, both in and out of the UK. We should also consider the effects of immigration on gospel spread. At the moment, we have the world on our doorstep, here like we never have before. A number of theological seminaries here in the UK have expressed a concern about what we in the EU may mean, not will mean, for those coming in, to such seminaries from the EU, and who are being taught soundly in sound Bible teaching here, and then going home to teach that abroad. Essentially, we have a big role in creating missions within the EU here. Again, it's unknown, but it does show us that it's worth thinking about gospel priorities over our own priorities, and trusting our decisions in the Lord.